My name is Michael Coates, and these conversations highlight the challenges, achievements, and societal issues within social housing. In this episode, we speak with one of the UK's leading tower block fire safety experts. We speak about his early life, joining the British Army, and spending over two decades in Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Service. We also talk about high-rise fires, Grenfell, benign neglect, and the things we can do to improve fire safety across housing. This podcast was created by Combat Pest Control in partnership with HRRB Fire Safety. Episode 7, Phil Murphy. This is Breaking the Cycle. Born in Manchester.
I was in a place called Stretford, in a three-bedroom council house, a terraced council house, and it was called King's Lane. It was a big housing estate, and I was born in the front bedroom.
Oh, really? Not even born in hospital?
Nope, I was born in the front bedroom of a council house.
Yeah, was you low-income family, or was it middle-class?
Yeah, we were a low-income family surrounded by quite a lively little Irish immigrant community, of which my parents were a part, having come over from Ireland. And when I was born, I was the fourth in line. I already had two sisters and a brother that were older than me, so it was fairly crowded. And then 7 years later, my mum had a pair of twins, so it became very, very crowded, and we moved to a slightly larger council house.
Yeah. And what was life then? Was it a rough upbringing? Was it aggressive in the area, or was it just a normal working class environment?
Yeah, you'd call it quite rough, I guess. It was a very working class estate. Most dads were out working every hour God sent, and most mums were bringing up kids in the days when it was a job in itself doing that. Really, bringing up a family, we didn't have washing machines and, you know, these luxuries like that. It was a full time job and really hard work for my mum, bringing up that many children.
And that was at the '70s.
Yeah. I was born in 1966, and the twins came along in the early '70s. Mm. So there were six of us.
Why did you join? Why did you join up in? Was it 83?
Yeah, it was 83. It was hopelessness, really. I remember growing up, and older lads would leave school and their dad would get them a job in a factory, or their uncle would get them an apprenticeship with the council, or the next door neighbour would get them a job delivering. But for some reason, all that had gone. You know, there didn't seem any avenues into work, really, the industries were closing down left, right, and centre. So there was a tremendous air of hopelessness around working class communities at that time. And a friend of my brother's had joined up, and he came home on leave, and he'd got his driving licenses and all this sort of thing, and was doing exciting stuff. And then, believe it or not, I went along with a guy I was working with who wanted to go to the Army Careers Office. He wanted to go and sign up. And 3 months later, I was sat on a train. Yeah, because I went in and signed up. I was only supposed to be going with him for company. But I ended up having that conversation with the people in the Careers Office. And I joined the Junior Leader Regiment Royal Corps Transport on the 4th of January, 1983.
Mm. And then, did you enjoy that? Did you thrive in that environment?
I did. It was tough, but I did thrive. I grew up really and became a man. I did that for 5 years. At first, I was a little bit bored. I was a driver, but then I went into radio operating instead, and I found that really engaging and enjoyed that work. So I was a radio operator with a squadron of 22,500 litre aviation fuel transporters.
Mm, that's easy to say, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah. Gradually, as I was over in Germany at the time, I did a stint in Canada, which was fabulous. Did a stint in Berlin, which was fabulous. But then I was back in West Germany, and I was just a little bit lost again. I didn't feel like the army was my true home. I think I was a bit of a pacifist deep down. And I lost a really good mate in an accident, and I was really disappointed and disillusioned with the way that they dealt with it. So I ended up signing off, and in my early 20s, I left after doing just over 5 years.
And so the disillusion, I mean, that rings true kind of again and again, really. And that's why a lot of lads leave in their early 20s. But I think there's a, especially with you, there's a searching for service. So when did you join the fire service? When did you join the fire brigade?
90s, early to mid 90s, about 94, I think. Well, actually, it was probably about 10 years after I joined the 1993. Yeah, I was a bit bored having done military service, which was, you know, full on and exciting stuff. And I was starting to twiddle my thumbs a bit. And just by coincidence, I was at a wedding and sat down beside a guy who was a firefighter. And it was like a light bulb moment. I thought, oh, I'll have a crack at that. That sounds good. And that's how that came about.
And then, so who did you join?
Greater Manchester County.
Talk me through the process then. So you, in the early, kind of early to mid-90s, you'd just apply or wait for a recruitment?
Yeah. I went along to a fire station, and they gave me a written application form, and then invited along for various tests and one thing and another, until eventually getting in and then realizing, because when we did our training, it was a bit like military. It was a residential course, and we were all in rooms of four. And in each room of four firefighter recruits, there was one former service person to show them how to do the ironing and to box the beds and polish the shoes and all that stuff. So it was a bit like going back in time for a while. It was, you know, I walked in, I thought, oh God, what have I let myself in for here? Two big tall guys in these like hotly pressed uniforms at the front door screaming at us when we arrived. I thought, oh no, here we go again. But it was, you know, that was a residential element. That was a 12-week period. It was tough. It was tough, but it was, again, it was one of those periods of growth, really, where you start to push yourself and find what you're capable of.
Mm. And then did you just join a station? Did you just join a watch?
I did. After 12 weeks. But your full probationary training period goes on. Well, it went on for 4 years then. But after your 12 weeks, you'd go to a fire station. And I'll never forget, because the one I was posted to had a bit of a reputation. It was Moss Side Fire Station. It was like one of the busiest fire stations in Europe. It was completely surrounded by flats. It had been involved not long before in the riots. And particularly Green Watch had a reputation for being very militant and tough. And I'll never forget when we're all there in the reading out, where you're going. And he said, Murphy, Greenwatch, Moss Side. And everybody just went, ooh. And then the first time, because it was good manners to go along and introduce yourself before you actually started your first shift. So I'd found out when the lads were working, and I was on holiday having a break after my initial training. And I went to see them, and I parked up on the opposite side of the yard from the fire station. And they knew who I was when I got out of the car. And as I'm walking slowly across the yard towards the fire station, they're all stood at the back doors, closing them. that's the sort of place it was. But
I love stuff like that, because it's like that facade. It's hard, or it's perceived to be hard, to get in. But if you don't do that effort, if you don't make the effort to go and introduce yourself, and you don't, and then accept the fact and just stand there, you know, laughing at the door being closed.
I just thought it was really funny. I really did. At home, I felt a little bit at home straight away.
Yeah. and then did you then, I know, you know, often places can be seen as, you know, militant, but that comes for a reason, really. And that's about protecting each other and looking after each other and setting a standard. Was that the case?
It was. Strangely coincidental that a series of really memorable disasters that had happened in Manchester, Greenwatch had been on every time. You know, they'd had the fire at Manchester Airport, multi-fatal fire in a plane on the runway. That was a Greenwatch. The Woolworths fire in Manchester, I don't know if you remember that one, in which 10 people died. That was Greenwatch. So they were toughened experienced guys at a time when, you know, your PPE leggings were made out of plastic and your helmet was made out of cork. You know, the BA sets were, you know, 30 odd kilos. These were tough lads that had working in a very, very busy fire station in a part of Manchester that was synonymous for its troubles, really, that neighbourhood.
Mm. Well, even me, you know, coming from Hull, living a lot in London, being in the military as well, even I didn't know what Mossad was.
Yeah.
And this reputation was that community, was it aggressive towards you as a
no.
as a firefighter?
No, it had its moments when the police had almost tried to pull the fire services in, such as the Strangeways riots. You know, they tried to get the fire service to direct jets of water onto the prisoners on the roof, but of course they refused. But with that sort of thing going on, not far away from the riots, you know, it could quite easily have turned nasty.
Mm. Well, what one redirected fire hose and a jet of water, mate, and then the trust's gone.
That's it. Absolutely.
So during that period, then are you getting involved? Are you learning? Are you becoming more empathetic to the situation? As a whole within society with regards to fire prevention, how to deal with people, are you becoming, I suppose, a more well-rounded individual?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the area where it was didn't bother me at all because I'd grown up just up the road in Stretford. It wasn't far away. So it was where everybody else seemed to want to avoid it. I was quite okay with working there. And that environment wasn't unfamiliar to me. So it didn't put me off in any way, shape or form at all being at Moss Side. But, I mean, as you do with any sort of safety related role, really, as you start to learn and, appreciate, you know, what your purpose is and what message you want to get across to people, in an effort to make them safer at home as well. Because, you know, let's not beat about the bush. You'd see some horrific things that shouldn't have happened. So it becomes a journey then, doesn't it, to try and reduce the number of times these preventable accidents occur.
And with regards to kind of the firefighter, that, you know, that watch, it is a vocation and people want to be the best, don't they? They want to be the best firefighters because of, you know, it's so important. It's important for the people around them. Was there a sense of professionalism?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we'd all be in the gym every day, for example, in our own time, not because we had to, but because we knew it was in our own interests and that we'd perform better out there if we were fit individuals. So there was that level of conscientiousness and the knowledge that on a busy station, you know, it's physically, it's some days it would be very, very testing indeed. You'd hardly get back to the fire station at all. You know, that's how busy we were. We'd go from one fire to the next sometimes. And that was really physically testing. So it was about, you know, the logical thing to do was to professionalise, really, and make sure that you're in the right state of mind and right state of fitness to be able to sustain a level of effort that might be required right at the end of a 15-hour night shift that's been very, very busy.
And I'm kind of leading this question, but you're not going to any job, any shout. You're not going there feeling and thinking, we'll go second rate here. You're going there and every single time wanting the best outcome.
Yeah, there were certain triggers, if you like, that would give you a kind of a level that you'd adopt before you arrived. One good example is if a report came over the radio when you were on the way to a job, that it was a person's reported. Now, that would mean that somebody had called in and said, I think there's somebody trapped in the property. And you know that under those circumstances, you may have to pull up and run straight into a house that's on fire with very little information.
When you get a call where there's a child involved and you know you're going to deal with a child, the nervous system knows what to do, and that fight, well, it's a fight that kicks in. It is a very strange situation for firefighters to be in, where every single focus, the whole demeanor of the appliance changes everyone within it. I think I'm right in saying that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's when you're facing the prospect of having to do that, you're about to enter a very, very serious, very dangerous situation and taking some known risks. And it's important that you do so with a mission at the forefront of your mind, if you like, because if you haven't, you won't be able to do it. You know, running into a building that's got a serious fire going in it is something that takes a certain way of thinking to do so without killing yourself in the process.
But it's very refined thinking. It's very focused and purpose-driven thinking, but it's backed up with excellent systems, processes, and training. So you go on this kind of autopilot of going, well, this is what we've got to do now. This is how we're going to check this kit. This is how I'm going to don this piece of equipment. And this is how we're going to all going to work together to make sure we are safe and well. You later on in your career, you went on to fire prevention. How did you go about that? How did you get to that stage?
Well, if I can just say, with regards to what we were just saying, you're absolutely right with all those training and all those systems. But in that sort of circumstance, you'd pull up being the first there and immediately break most of the rules because you weren't supposed to run in a building without somebody with you and all that sort of thing. And you'd immediately split up. You weren't supposed to do that. One would go upstairs, one would go downstairs. You weren't supposed to do that. You know, there was a whole load of rules that you'd break straight away. And it was just one of those things where everybody knew these rules got broken, but nobody ever really addressed it. You know, but they did eventually, of course. Like, you know, they're more strict now about entering that kind of environment. But yeah, I studied fire engineering in my own time and studied for promotional exams. Things were going well. And eventually I went to a place called Moreton in Marsh, which is like a national college for firefighters. And I went there for various stints. Each one was weeks at a time to learn all about different types of building instructions, construction, the building regulations, and things like that. Some really sort of things that have stayed with me the whole time and been tremendously useful, really, was being able to recognize or know roughly what to expect when you arrive at a certain type of building that's on fire and how that building might behave in a fire. And I think these are some of the skills that have been lost, really. There's a lot of talk now about how much the skill levels have reduced in our modern fire services. And I think the importance of that is something that's on people's minds at the moment, being able to recognize a certain number of things about a building that's on fire is very useful when you're committing people to fire in it.
So fire behavior and the training to deal with a material, really, a flammable material.
Yeah, and the methods that have been used to construct buildings. You know, you would have an idea of where the compartmentation might be in a building and where the fire barriers might be in a building, and that would feed into your tactics. And also the indications that a building. Sorry, mate. Also the indications that a building's starting to fail. Because the structure and the materials will start to tell you things. And if you can read it, then it might be telling you something very, very important indeed about the building and you know, the manner to which it's stable or not.
How did you see fire prevention change over the course of your career?
Well, at the time when I did this training, we were approaching a major change in fire safety legislation. It's in 2006. An act was signed off in 2005, the Regulatory Reform Fire Safety Order, it was called, and that came into being in 2006. And that was a big landscape changer in fire safety, because although I'd had to go away and learn how fire officers used to go along to buildings and inspect them, I'd had to learn all that. But at the same time, with the introduction of this new law, it became the responsibility of the people that owned or ran the buildings to get somebody in privately called a fire risk assessor and do an assessment of the building to tell them if it was adequately safe for the purpose that it was intended. So we've sort of had to learn two jobs, really, the old way of doing things and the new way of doing things. You know, risk assessments at work on the fire ground had just become a new thing as well. The same transition that was happening in the workplaces that we visited, it was happening in our own. So we'd had to start risk assessing things. That was quite a new thing for us as firefighters.
But is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, depends where you're coming from, really. I mean, we could talk all day about whether there should be more fire safety officers doing, you know, audits and inspections on buildings. But in theory, the people in the private sector can do that. But I do think that there was a vacuum when they introduced this new law, because there was no readily available national team of fire risk assessors to go out and start doing this job. There weren't that many people teaching how to do fire risk assessments. But crucially, people that owned large or complex buildings weren't getting much guidance from government as to how to identify somebody that's got the skills and competence to do a building that's got in any complications of any sort. So it took a while for it to kick in fully. It certainly took a while for large organisations like councils to get on board with it and to get all their buildings fire risk assessed. And I mean, you could still argue now that really the necessary guidance to help people get good fire risk assessments, some people would still say that it's not really there yet. You know, it still doesn't exist. And the competency framework that's being formed now is on the back of a report by somebody called Dame Judith Hackett that took place on the back of Grenfell. And it was something that she identified was the lack of a structure to fire risk assessors to judge their skill and competency level quite easily when you want to have a building fire risk assessed.
Mm. Is that when you're in the fire service, in the fire brigade, and this is part of your job, is that frustrating to see, I suppose, a Wild West approach to private assessors?
Well, yeah. Because I think some people expected the fire service to do it. You know, they were quite accustomed to being able to call the fire service and just get some free advice. And it wasn't really for the fire service or fire officers to tell these people, choose that person or choose that person. Whoever's responsible for it is supposed to choose it themselves. You know, it's their responsibility. That's why they're called the responsible person. They have to make decisions like that so that they can stay fully informed about their own fire safety in that building. But a lot of people were used to that sort of advice coming from the fire service, but all of those resources were withdrawn from the fire services. One of the motivations for doing it was so that lots of fire safety officers could be removed from the fire service, and it would be a reduction in the cost required to run a fire service.
Why did you leave?
I had a good offer, had a decent offer to work in the private sector, because these skills that I'd picked up in the fire service, because of that change in the law, there was now more demand for them in the private sector.
Well, and so was it a financial reason, or
I was a bit bored as well. You know, I'd gone from being on a really busy fire engine to being at a desk a lot of the time. I was feeling a bit fed up. There were strikes, you know, taking place. That was really, really unpleasant. You know, I for me as a homeowner at the time, living on my own, I didn't have any safety net, really. You know, I didn't have a partner who was also out working that could pay the mortgage. So to go on strike, you know, and to lose that money was it was really, really serious.
And it affected
the work environment. You know what I mean? It infiltrates when something like that is going on. It's a very stressful time for any workforce, and there are people that aren't in favour of it. There are people that are. Loads of tensions and stresses. It was, it wasn't very nice working there anymore.
So divisive, so political, especially when you've got you said a workforce, but it's not just a workforce. It's a skilled workforce who want the best for people. And also when you twin that with the fact that certain types of media can demonize firefighters, no firefighter wants to strike. That is a fact.
Absolutely.
This is why it can become this, what's the word? Like to put it nicely, like an unpleasant environment to be around. I was going to swear then, but it's not a nice place to be around. What did you do next then when you left? What was the next job for you?
I've got into property management in essence, and started to demonstrate what a good fire safety management system looks like to the organisation I was working with, because that was a prevailing or an emerging issue, if you like, because of this change in the law. They were asked by the people whose properties they managed, can you do this as part of your service for us? And I started to show them how to put some structure to that. And I was then gradually asked to focus on managing agent contracts, where we were managing properties for people that had particularly tall or complicated buildings that required that extra level of expertise.
And that covers the property management, the building, insurance, peace of mind, accountability. That's almost on you, is it? To make sure that it's safe.
That would be the nature of the contract, really, is that the person that was identified in law as being the responsible person, that would usually be the owner, and we'd sign detailed contracts with them telling them that we'd take responsibility for these aspects, namely the fire safety was my main concern, and we worked with one national provider that I worked with for the last few years, an international company that had like 12 or 13 big tall or complicated buildings nationwide, and in those buildings they had 20,000 staff, and they'd invested a hell of a lot, and some of them had quite complex fire safety arrangements and fire engineered solutions in them, and it was my job to help the building managers understand why certain aspects of the fire safety management should be prioritized and how important it was in the whole building management piece, really.
Was it good? Was that private sector done well?
It's really hard for me to answer that because I can only talk of the experience that I had. You know, it's not as easy as some people make it out to be, really. If you've got a busy building with thousands of people going in and out of it each day, it needs a degree of diligent and careful and mindful, knowledgeable, skillful management. And when you're faced with that on a day-to-day basis, it's very easy for some of the things that you are not immediately in front of your face to drop by the wayside a little bit. And that was the thing that I was most keen to prevent happening. And to do that, I kept it at the forefront of people's minds in various ways. But I'd go to places sometimes that I might be asked to do a one-off visit to a building, for example. And I would find there that things had fallen by the wayside. They weren't properly structured, or they weren't properly administered, or quite simply, they'd taken on a building and put a manager in there, and he didn't recognise some of the fire safety systems. And if you don't recognise them, then you're not going to maintain them properly.
Can you give some examples?
Well, a really good example is ventilation. This is one of the things that's been found is probably most likely to not be functioning correctly in a building that has it. Because in a modern building, you'll often find that there's an extraction system built into a corridor or lobby somewhere as a means to control where the smoke will go and to pull it out of the building to keep an exit route clear. But in some cases, if you didn't know what you were looking at, it just looked like something on the wall. It's just like a grill, almost like a ventilation grill, you know, and these things have to be regularly tested to make sure that when there's a fire, the fire system detects it and then employs the ventilation system if it's the right thing to do. So you've got a system that detects the smoke. And that goes back to the fire alarm, and the fire alarm says, okay, turn on the ventilation, and that will suck the smoke out. Now, the ventilation system itself is a mechanical system with a fan, you know, and grills and things like that. And if you don't check that works on a regular basis, then you might find it doesn't when you need it. You know, it's quite a lot of fires have had that issue, and it's been very, very serious when it has happened. When the ventilation has failed.
Because you look at something so simple as ventilation, and you look at, well, you're creating a survivable atmosphere for not only the people that are trying to get out, but the people that are trying to come in to deal with it. You're keeping things clear, you're keeping the heat down, you're really maintaining a positive environment, or as positive as it can be. With what your experience dictates here, did the private sector, I think you've alluded to it, invest in that? And did you see it in other areas where it wasn't quite as I suppose, invested in?
Yeah, I think it's down to a person that's managing a building to make the case for the maintenance of it and correct, competent, adequate maintenance of the safety systems. So if you've got somebody on site that doesn't fully understand these things, and in large and complex buildings, it's sometimes not straightforward. And you sometimes haven't got all the original documentation that tells you what the fire strategy is for that building. So you're trying to read the strategy, if you like. And sometimes there'll be things that don't immediately jump out at you, that you learn about the building because you're there every day, and then something will emerge that you didn't know was there. You know, I've known people have ventilation systems pointed out to them that they just didn't know were there, and they haven't done for several years. And then I've had to make the case that under this British standard, you need to test it with this regularity. Yeah, it's a bill. You know, that's the bottom line. It's going to cost you. But I think the awareness of people as to the seriousness of these tasks has waned over the years, and been allowed to relax. And I think we're seeing the cost of that nationally now, where a lot of buildings are playing catch up to make them safe again.
Where were you when Grenfell happened?
I was in a flat on the 8th floor of a 24-storey concrete building with a single staircase that had 6 flats on each floor. Now, I don't know if you recognise that description, but that could apply to Grenfell Tower or the place where I was living at the time.
So that was in Manchester?
Yeah, in Trafford in Manchester, a housing association flat.
What was the impact, immediate impact of it?
Oh, well, shocking. Absolutely devastating, really, to be honest, to sit in a block of flats and watch that happen to a block of flats, you know, with my son asleep in the bedroom, knowing that there were people trapped in that building. It was just like devastating, like nothing else really I could describe. It's just, it was like torture, knowing what those people are going through there, and knowing what those firefighters are going through, and knowing what those families are going through. You know, there were people at the windows, and their relatives were stood outside talking to them on the phones and watching them gradually get consumed by fire and smoke. The most awful, awful thing that you can imagine for all those families to have gone through that in such a public way. Just shouldn't have happened. Absolutely should not have happened.
With your experience and skill and diligence, what did you do with where you said you were living in somewhere very similar. What did you do?
Well, I'd never really looked. As crazy as it would sound, you know, it was my full-time job to go and look at buildings. But I never looked at the one that I lived in. I just assumed that it would be diligently managed in a way that kept us all safe. But as soon as the penny dropped and I started looking, I saw loads of things that really alarmed me. You know, when I did start looking, I was like, this doesn't look quite right. This doesn't look quite right. This doesn't look quite right. And I got myself quite worried. So I got hold of a couple of the fire risk assessments for the building as well, which didn't make me feel any better. They looked to be of a really poor standard. And they didn't tell me very much about the building that made me feel better, or that gave the impression that it was being well managed. It was the opposite. I thought, what I'm seeing here are the indications that fire safety has been a secondary consideration for years. And when they're having their annual checks, they're getting somebody who isn't taking a very diligent look at the building at all, or at the maintenance and management of it. So I put all of these concerns into a formal report. And at the time, prior to this, I was chair of the Tenants and Residents Association. We had a fantastic little community. We were taking over management of the building ourselves. You know, we were going to manage it and remove the housing association from the equation when it came to things like caretaker and what have you. We were going to directly manage some of these things ourselves. So it was going really well. You know, we had a really thriving little community there that everybody looked after each other. And then as soon as I'd drawn up this report, I sent it off to a few people. I got the feedback I got initially, it gave me some encouragement. But then a week or two passed and nothing had happened, nothing at all. And I was invited along to a meeting at which there would be various councillors, some people from the Housing Association and somebody from the fire service. So I went along and I took the report with me. And I put a copy of it in front of the fire safety officer from Greater Manchester Fire Service. And I said, I've got some really serious concerns about this building and I'd like you to go and have a look at it, please. And after the meeting, he went and had a look at it. And the next morning, there were 20-odd contractors' vans in the car park. And he'd looked at the things that I had pointed out, and he told them that if they didn't pull their fingers out and sort out some of these issues, that they were gonna serve a prohibition notice, you know, and force them to empty the building. So immediately they started looking more closely at the things that I'd pointed out. We'd had a massive refurbishment and it had completely ruined the compartmentation right throughout the building.
Explain what is compartmentation?
Compartmentation is the way that the building is divided up by fire barriers. So there's compartmentation between all the apartments and the escape route. There's compartmentation between the floors above and below. There's compartmentation between the flats. And where you have channels that run through the building to carry your waste, to carry your water, to carry air, to carry services, to carry internet cables, phone, when you have these channels that run right through a building, they're a risk because they go through the floors. So they have to be compartmented too, so that you don't get fire going in there and bypassing other forms of compartmentation. So it's a built-in way of dividing the building up into areas that keep separation of an area on fire from an area that isn't.
And that's to suppress the spread of fire. So it may happen in one specific area, like a flat, but then it's contained within that one area so it doesn't spread up, left, right, down. It stays very local, so it can be dealt with in a very simple way, I suppose.
It contains it for a period sufficient to allow for the arrival of and action of the local fire brigade to interfere and to stem the growth of fire within that unit. Mm. The idea being, crucially, that it contains the fire within that unit. But of course, buildings are built with that, if they're built correctly, which is another thing altogether. It's one thing to build something in a laboratory and test it and see it pass the test. It might be something else altogether to repeat that and recreate it on a building site when it's -2 in the middle of December, you know? So the construction of the building is absolutely crucial to get that right. But then the majority of the building's lifespan is going to be used building. So you have to carry on managing these things. And in the building where I was living, they'd carried out some major works, which involves running new plumbing throughout the building to every single flat. And on occasions between flats, there was new drainage system installed, new ventilation system installed. And all of these things collectively had caused a lot of holes to be made in walls that were supposed to be compartmenting walls and not have holes in them, because holes allow the passage of fire and smoke.
Mm. I mean, it sounds such a simple thing, but these corners are cut because of financial reasons and laziness. And like you said, you know, it's 1 degree on a wet February and you just want to get this work done. You know, in a conversation we had prior, and it's something I've never, this sounds ridiculous, I've never even considered it in this sense, was building regs or building regulations. And what you said, the difference between life safety and building resilience. Could you just talk about that?
People seem to think that the building regulations are formulated in such a way that it encourages people to build a building that won't burn down. That's not the case. The aim of building regulations is to keep parts of the building safe enough for the period that is required for people to get out of it. That's all. So if you were to build a building with property protection in mind, you'd probably put a sprinkler in every room because you're going to suppress a fire quickly and the damage to the building will be minimized. But that's not the aim of building regulations. Building regulations are aimed at life safety, which means that it gets people out of the building. It doesn't mean it builds a building that's highly resistant to the spread of fire necessarily.
Do we see this in, I mean, there's a million questions you can ask from that. But do we see that more in deprived areas, low income areas, social housing areas? Do we see this way of building?
It varies. In Wales now, if you want to build a house, you have to put a sprinkler in it. That will save lives. Absolutely no doubt about it whatsoever. It's been done in some towns in America with, you know, the kind of dramatic improvements in fire safety that you'd expect, really. It's not a panacea. Nothing is. It doesn't stop all people dying in fires, but they will stop certain things from happening. They'll stop a lot of the damage that comes from a fire. And crucially, they will, as a rule, stop multi-fatal fires. So in the fires that you do have, you'll, if there's a fatality, you'll find there's one fatality and then the sprinklers put the fire out. So it avoids multi-fatal fires, and it invariably prevents the fire from travelling outside the room where it started, which is important.
So why hasn't that been adopted in the UK, in England or Scotland?
It's there in, under certain conditions at the moment, with buildings of a certain height. But what we've never introduced is a requirement to retrospectively fit sprinklers into older high-rise buildings. So we've got older high-rise buildings out there that are more than 50 years old. They've got a single staircase. They've got no fire extinguishers. They've got no fire alarms. And they've got no sprinklers. Because we don't change things retrospectively, they've stayed like that. So whilst new buildings above a certain height are now getting sprinklers, it doesn't mean that we have to install them in these older buildings that never had them.
If we go back a bit to Grenfell and we look at cladding, do we know now that, what, I mean, is that, that's, is it 4 years on? Yeah.
Four
and a half years on. Do we know how many high-rise buildings there are just with cladding that it's insufficient, it's a fire risk, a fire hazard?
We don't know how many high-rise buildings there are.
Well, so we don't know how many high-rise buildings there are.
We don't even know how many high-rise buildings there are yet.
So no one's done a count of the buildings?
Not yet. Not one that they've finished.
So if we don't know how many high-rise buildings there are, we don't know how many high-rise buildings there are in severe, in a severe category of fire risk.
There you go.
Four and a half years.
There's a big exercise underway at the moment that's been going on for more than a year. What are they calling it? It's not the building safety audit, but something like that, that fire officers are doing now. If my memory serves me correctly, they were given about £20 million to do this a couple of years ago by the government, and they're expecting to report their final figures next month. At the moment, though, I've seen Andrew Rowe talking, he's the London Fire Chief. I've seen him talking about it at the Grenfell Inquiry. And again, don't quote me on this, but I think I'm roughly correct in saying that they've got about 8,000 high-rise buildings, and at about 1,200 of them, they've found things that have seriously worried them to the point where they've changed the evacuation strategy in the building and required that the building get people to patrol it all night looking for fires, basically.
So you've got fire wardens on all the time in this high rise. And this is just high rise as well.
Yeah.
And
I mean, there are other buildings which aren't high rise that have, you know, need serious attention, that have got serious problems. But yeah, he was just talking about the high-rise buildings.
And generally, I associate high-rise buildings with, I don't associate them with wealth. I don't associate MPs, members of parliament, big CEOs of business, the middle class. I don't associate those properties, those buildings, with those individuals. So am I right in saying that it generally is low income, it generally is vulnerable, or am I way off there?
Well, you kind of are a bit. In the older blocks that we've been talking about that were around when I was growing up as a kid, you know, that were built in the 60s and 70s. That generally is the case, because they were built by local authorities invariably for social housing. But in recent years, what we've seen is a real proliferation now of luxury high-rise developments, which are the opposite. You know, I don't know if you remember, but a few months ago, there was pictures in the paper of one where there was two high-rise residential buildings with a Perspex swimming pool joining them up at the top, you know. So high-rise living has gone through a transformation, really. I do think that the first kind of wave of high-rise buildings was a little bit of an experiment. You know, and there were a lot of problems with some of the buildings, you know, infestations of mice and insects and things like that, or serious damp problems, you know, that the kinds of things that are not easy to solve in a building of that type and structure. But they've gradually worked out how to ventilate these things properly. Lifts have become more reliable. They've worked out how to deal with any outbreaks or infestations and things like that. So through that first wave of social housing, the problems came up and in a lot of cases were resolved to the point where now they can build a building that isn't going to get any damp and isn't going to get any infestations and things like that. So they're a slightly more attractive proposition now, I think, than they were back then. And certainly in Manchester, I mean, you know, the number of really tall residential buildings going up in Manchester is quite phenomenal, but a lot of them have still only got one staircase.
So we're going away from this post-Second World War build where we needed to get a lot of people into small areas because of bombed out buildings, especially in these metropolitan cities, London, Manchester, Birmingham, places like that. And that evolution has gone now into, you know, you just said it then, Manchester. You got Perspex swimming pools in between two high rise. So it isn't just a low income problem. This is a spread across society. This cladding fire risk, that's just cladding fire risk we're talking about, because we don't actually fully appreciate and understand the magnitude of it. I'm kind of just summarizing what you've told me, and correct me if I'm wrong in any of this. So it's going across all society. We don't quite know exactly what the risk is. If we look at then homeowners, people who own their properties in these high rise, what is being done for them? What support is being done for them?
There's a loan fund or a building safety fund that the government are administering. Very mixed feedback about it, really. And the general sense is that won't be enough. A lot of leaseholders, it was interesting that you used the word homeowner, because what you own is a lease. Now, that isn't you owning any of the structure at all. All you own is a piece of paper that says you can live there. Now, part of that piece of paper says you've got to maintain it, but you don't own it. So when a problem with the building arises, it's not the person that owns the building that is going to pay for the repairs. It's the leaseholders that are living in the building. So although in some cases buildings have been built really poorly or managed really poorly and need quite a lot of work doing, the person that owns the building isn't the one that's paying for the work. They pass the bills down to the people that are in it. That's why leaseholders, in some cases, people that are living in these flats, are getting bills that are a higher price tag on the bill than what their own flat is worth. You know, we're talking absolute life-changing sums of money that they've been asked to provide within a space of weeks.
Through no fault of their own?
No, paying for the mistakes of others.
I want to jump us on, because you could have your own podcast, mate, and just do one thing, you know, a week. I was interested to hear, and I'm going to jump back to the Grenfell situation where it's very documented that there was a lot of vulnerable people. There was a lot of social housing. There was a lot of refugees, people who've migrated over, who'd been put in the care of their landlords, and who are now rightfully so many have lost their lives and lost property and lost everything they had and kind of not been looked after in the way they should have been. I was really sad when I heard your explanation about what happened in New York?
Hmm.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah. During the Nixon period, when Nixon was president, he was communicating with this organization called the Rand Institute. Rand being a person that had some very outspoken, unusual views on how he should do things, if you like. And Nixon was in conversation with these people in an effort to find ways to run things more efficiently. And they took a cold, hard look at the cost of responding to all the fire alarms that were going off in New York City and said, why are we doing this? The vast majority of them are false alarms that we don't need to go to. So they advised the city to stop attending fire alarms. And that had a profoundly negative impact on one small portion of the community. And that was invariably people that were poor and that lived in tenement blocks that were having fires and the alarms were being ignored. So the number of people that were dying in fires in buildings of that type suddenly shot up because they couldn't get out and the fire brigade were late because they didn't respond to alarms anymore. They waited for a phone call.
Mm. So they're reported to persons reported instead of fire
instead
prevention.
Of an automatic fire alarm.
Yeah.
You know, in their blocks of flats, they had fire alarm systems. Which are there to speedily notify the people in the building that they need to move away from a hazard and to also automatically summon the fire service to come to a fire. But, you know, such is the nature of fire alarms. A lot of them were false alarms. They still are now. But to turn around and stop going to all of them, because the ones that are very important are just a small percentage, is really, they gave it the term benign neglect. And that rings in my ears as something that we've seen creep up in high-rise fire safety management in this country, is a kind of benign neglect where the people that are managing them, in many cases, they don't even know what they don't even know. You know, the number of cases I've seen, for example, where fire doors, flat front doors in high-rise residential buildings have been changed multiple times because the people that are managing the building were unable to even select a person or procure the services of a person that would get the right door. You know, that's quite a simple example, but it's quite a fundamental thing, a fire door. And you would think that somebody that owns a property, you know, it might be 50 years old. It might be a 20-store old high-rise. But if you want to build a 20-story high-rise building, it's worth a lot of money. You know, that property is bringing in a lot in rental. And if the people that are taking that rent money don't even know how to buy a fire door for it, what does that tell us when fire doors are an absolutely fundamental element of the fire safety there? A guy in a block that I used to live in, where I lived when the fire happened at Grenfell Tower, the one I was talking about a minute ago, a mate of mine that lived in that block, he didn't have a great relationship with the landlord, and a lot of people didn't. They were quite rude. And he didn't want them to replace his front door, because he thought the door that they were putting on wasn't to the correct specification, right? So he said, everything you've told me about the door that you want to put on my flat, it's not enough. As far as I'm concerned, it's not a good enough door. That's what he said. So they waited until he wasn't there and they broke in and replaced the door. He was at his mother's funeral. when they broke into his flat and replaced his front door. And a few weeks later, they had to go and knock back again and apologise because the door that they'd put on was not up to specification. He was right all along.
If I said to you, with you not saying people's names, but if I said to you, show me the bodies, what does that conjure up?
That conjures up a certain person that has largely been responsible for building regulations remaining unchanged in ways that some people reported were very dangerous. Some people were seeing things in buildings that gave indications that a catastrophic, multi-fatal fire was on the horizon. And I've spoken to more than one person that went to the highest level they could to try and instigate change in building regulations. And that's the response that they got. Show me the bodies.
You know, from the Rand Institute in the Nixon period to show me the bodies now, it's history. It could be history repeating itself. What needs to change?
Nearly everything, really, when you look at the expanse and totality of the failure of the entire regulatory system, from the way that products are manufactured, tested, and deemed suitable for certain things, to the ways that things are built according to the regulations that have got some problems in, the ways that things are sometimes built badly because of poor workmanship, the way that things are sometimes designed wrongly, the extent to which value engineering takes place on a construction site that replaces items of the structure, often without consulting an engineer or the architect, the way that buildings are managed, particularly high-rise residential buildings, needs a radical overhaul. And we've got probably a bill of somewhere in the region of £30 billion as a country to spend over the next 20 years just to get them up to scratch, those that have been done wrongly and those that have been badly managed. Now, that is a big price to pay for having shown a level of indifference that's completely inappropriate toward buildings that people sleep in.
We need to feel, and we have the right to feel safe in the place we live, the place we bring our children up and our families. Take this in the best possible way, and hopefully it's contextualized. Was Grenfell, it's a weird way of saying this, please, I'm not disrespecting anyone that was hurt or lost, you know, homes and possessions as well as individuals. I'll rephrase it. What are the positives to come from Grenfell?
Safer homes. We've got a phrase in this country for good reason, and it's safe as houses. Because when you're sat at home in your house with your family, that's got to be the ultimate in feeling safe and secure. Well, we didn't know that a lot of the buildings weren't as safe and secure as we'd like. If we now see thousands and thousands and thousands of families and people get the level of fire safety at home that they should have, then that's a good thing. if we see fire safety regulations generally improve fire safety for people that live in flats, then that's a good thing. We seem to have stopped learning things somewhere and stopped trying to improve the safety in certain types of buildings, and we shouldn't have done that. Any safety professional should be continually trying to improve their record, and we didn't. We sat back and we allowed a lax piece of guidance to affect thousands and thousands of families in a very negative way that brings risk to their lives that they shouldn't be carrying. If we get to a point where people are safer at home and everybody knows that they can get out of a building if they need to get out of a building, then we'll be at a better place.
Phil, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.